Kevin Taylor me. Who is this?
I think it's me.
You're here before Christy, which honestly is not surprising.
Oh my gosh.
I know. We could just do it. I mean, do we need her? I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't know. We could just do it.
We could just do it.
We could do it.
We have to southern it up before the Colorado comes in. She's from Colorado. It's a big part of her identity, so don't be disparaging about Colorado. Do you have any feelings about Colorado?
I have no feelings about Colorado.
Well, that's good. How are you?
All I know is South Park. Yeah, I'm pretty good. Yeah.
Well, guys, welcome to Theology on the Rocks. Christy isn't here. And you know what?
We are recording, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, we've been recording for a minute. That wasn't just banter.
You can cut that out.
I'm not going to. We don't cut anything. Do you want to be our editor?
What's editing?
I mean, I don't know. I cut one thing one time that I'll tell you in real life. Look who decided to show up.
I didn't see the text.
Yeah. Kevin, Christy's also a youngest child. So
I literally was just sitting here watching my computer. Somehow I missed it.
So, welcome.
Christy. Hey.
We already talked some mad smack about Colorado before you got here.
You know what? Let's mark it on the calendar. Today is a day I am glad not to be in Colorado because it is snowing hard.
No, thank you.
And I was like, ooh, I don't want to drive in that anymore. That's yucky.
Christy drove me around AAR in Denver, and I swear, Kevin, I thought it was worse than driving with you.
Kevin, do you have a lot of snow driving experience?
No.
He's got going on the wrong way on an entrance ramp experience.
It's called driving by Zen.
We rode together to go to AR in San Diego. And so I rode back with him, and he legit went the wrong way on the road. And that was like, awesome. And I just started like looking at him and then getting increasingly concerned and being like, no.
And when you say drive to San Diego, you mean I drove to the airport from your home, which was like 5 miles. So
it was enough. That was enough.
I knew a shortcut.
And I was just like, what are you doing? Like, I was with you. We just ate cheeseburgers. We didn't drink whiskey. What are you doing?
Leah, you have some of the most interesting going to the airport stories.
I know.
It is a struggle for you.
It really is. And I've been on an airplane no less than 8 million times. But like, it just always is an adventure.
Every time.
Although I do like to make most things in my life seem like an adventure, even if they weren't. So
I'm the same.
But that was real. That story was real. So guys, once again, welcome to Theology on the Rocks. Now that Christy's here, we can say that. We have a special guest, which is Doctor. Are you a Reverend Doctor or are you Doctor?
I'm Reverend Doctor.
It's Reverend Doctor.
Reverend Doctor.
It's Reverend Doctor.
It is.
Ordained Methodist.
Bless your heart. But also, yes, the Reverend Doctor Kevin Taylor, who is forever my colleague. I'm not going to use past tense. Forever my colleague.
Aw.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, we live like very close to each other. We still hang out. So I have to say.
Colleague, always a colleague, really.
For sure. Because Christy's, I've met all of Christy's CCU people who don't work there anymore, and they all are just like it was yesterday. Well, I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say you're bonded by love, but sure.
We are bonded by love.
And Baptist trauma. Get in line, guys. Get in line. Welcome to the South. So yeah, Dr. Kevin Dealer and Reverend Dr. Kevin Dealer, and he was nice enough to come on the podcast and hang out with us. I mean, we are a delight.
We are. And also, I'm so excited. Leo and I have been talking about having you on for ages. So I'm so excited that it's actually happening.
Yay.
We got our stuff together.
Don't get too excited, Kevin. If your voice raises another octave, I might explode. So watch out.
Wind is raised, so,
Dr. Taylor, I'm Kevin. Kevin, when I'm with my students, they'll always be like, Dr. Taylor, this, Dr. Blah, this. And I'm like, yeah. I have to always say Dr., like refer to you as Dr. Taylor when students are around.
It's hard to break that habit.
It is. Because some of them call people by their first names. I'm not going to mention who those people are, but you know, Kevin. Yeah. And I was always like, that's not allowed. We worked too hard for that.
I don't know if Leah and I have talked about this in person. I can't remember if we talked about this on the podcast, but like, I feel very strongly that my students should call me Dr. Whaley for a lot of reasons. One of them is that I'm a woman who doesn't look necessarily like I look older than them for sure, but not like super authoritative kind of older. And so the doctor is necessary. But I'm always curious about whether or not men care about it.
Yeah, well, Kevin, as a representative of the
of the
male
man.
Species
of the male species
of the people from Mars, you know, personally, and part of it, I'm 51, so I care less. I mean, I don't want anything crude or overly familiar, and I don't court any of it. Like some
like
people,
they can't call you Kevin.
That would be a little weird.
Okay,
but.
They can call him like, Sexy Cheeks Taylor.
How did they know? That's my Discord handle. But some of them would have, some folks at our institution would have cute names like Doc or something.
Yeah.
I always thought that was all weird.
We have some of those too.
But yeah. I've had some students call me, I don't know, they've called me Mr. Thomas. I mean, I get, and I just don't, I'm like, whatever.
Or, oh, yeah.
You know,
I mean, so many of my students say Professor Whaley instead or, Mrs. Whaley, and then I'm always like, that's my mom. They get
that's
really
what
confused.
I do. I would correct them every this is gonna shock no one that I corrected them every time. They would say Mrs. Robinson. God, they love to do that.
Oh
yeah.
And I was like,
I got Mr. Kevin sometimes.
Mr. Kevin.
It's like I'm their preschool teacher.
When I first started teaching, a lot of my students did call me Christy though, and it was like a real fight to get them to stop. It was very weird. It was very presumptuous, but I had professors when I was an undergrad who went by their first names, and I don't remember feeling weird about that back then. Like it was like, oh, well, we're in college and the professors let you call you by their first name.
Were they guys though?
No, it was really a mix to the point where usually if I'm talking about any of my undergrad professors, I almost never call them Dr. So-and-so. It's almost always their first names or just last names, unless it's the count. And then obviously I have to call him the count. So
I have a professor who I had in undergrad who actually encouraged me to be a religion major. Shout out to Dr. Nash. And I can't not call him Dr. Nash. Now, keep in mind, this is a man who did teach me in undergrad. But then also he married me and Stuart. He was our minister. I was still calling him Dr. Nash. And now we're teaching, it was come full circle. We're actually teaching a class together next semester at Mercer. And I'm going to.
You're like still Dr.
I'm still
Nash.
Calling him Dr. Nash. Cute. I just can't get it out of my head.
No, I mean, I can't imagine my seminary professors. I can't. I think I would die before I would call them by their first names.
I remember we were in AAR Atlanta and he was like, do you want to get a drink? And I was like, oh my gosh, Dr. Nash. I'm like, I'm a married woman at this stage. And he married me.
He knows it.
He was present for that.
I was 30, like 5 or something. And I was like, oh my goodness.
You were in the club, the adult club.
I know. It was so weird. Anyway, so Kevin, I'm going to call you Kevin because we are friends, lives here in North Kakalaki with me, although he lives in the country. Country.
Well, I mean, it's a city of 18,000, so it's small, but it's...
Okay.
We do have mail service and garbage service, like so it's not quite...
Does Amazon come to you? Do you get
Amazon come? Yeah, but they have to cross the dam unless the beavers have taken out the dam, and then they get there. Yeah. There is a beaver. Like, the city spends a lot of time because it blocks up this creek. And I guess they're protected.
This is how you know, like, he's in the country.
Real.
Yeah. And so, like, he just keeps rebuilding the dam, and they have to tear it down because it stops up the creek and causes flooding. And the beaver's like, back at it.
Back so at weird. It again. He has one job. Like,
he has one job.
He's just gonna
job. And no one in Stanley's just going to go out and shoot him, I guess.
That's beaver. A little surprising.
I know. I thought so, too.
Stanley County is the place that he lives, which oftentimes it's funny because that region will refer to itself as the county and not like the towns. Like, I always hear people say I'm from Stanley County as opposed to
well,
like,
well, yeah,
oh, that's,
I guess, because none of them are that big.
Yeah. Thing.
Yeah. And well, Albemarle, you're doing
takes it's more syllables too. Albemarle takes a little.
I never get, and I to this day can't spell Meisenheimer, which is where our college was.
Right.
I'm like, that is too many vowels for my. And the thing too is because I have a little Southern child in my head, which Kevin, you know, I'm assuming you do too. None of the letters made sense where they were.
No.
And Albemarle is also spelled not the way that we're saying it. It doesn't make any sense.
Well,
either.
These are French and German words, so yeah, they're both foreign.
Which is lost on
yes.
us. So, Kevin's specialty, so he shares something in common with us other than being just cool,
yes.
is that he also got his PhD in the UK.
I noticed this when I was swiping pictures from...
Places. On his Tinder.
And doing Tinder profile pictures. And I was like, ooh, he also has UK robes on. So where did you do your doctoral?
I was at Cambridge.
Oh, so fancy.
Mm-hmm.
I knew a guy. That was there. That's how it happened.
How did you enjoy your time at Cambridge?
It was
everything?
Magical. It really was. Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
I can imagine.
Yeah. I mean, it was cold and weird. At, you know, oh. times, but yeah,
it's the UK. Yeah,
it's the UK.
I mean, we were higher north than you, so you can't really say much about cold.
No, but I've never had a non-heated bathroom. Like, wow, you just depend on the steam to make it warm in this room.
Oh God, yeah.
Our friends, it snowed in Scotland like this week, and my mother-in-law and also our friends were sending pictures, and I of course it looks gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
But in my head, all I could think was, oh my God, I could never shower again. I don't know how I did it.
Especially because the showers, like, don't have doors. You know, I was reminded of this recently.
Like, what do you mean the shower doesn't, like, oh, I see.
Like, half glass where it doesn't actually, like, cover the whole, like, if it's a bathtub, it doesn't go all the way over.
I thought you meant the bathroom. I was like, what kind of bathroom were you in that didn't have a door?
The shower itself. Those little, like, half glass things where you're like, keep the water to just right here.
Yeah, right. They're pointless. Yeah. Also, there's carpet in a lot of bathrooms, which...
Oh, yeah.
I have thoughts, but understand right. because it's so cold. They're like,
you
I
don't
need
want to step on the stuff, tile after.
Something comforting. So you liked Cambridge. What did you do your PhD on, Kevin, for RD?
I did it with sort of a theology and literature angle.
Ooh, Christy.
I think is one of Christy's interests. Yeah, I yeah, got right into now. The Catholic theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar.
Yes,
because he was into tragic literature, and he thought that Jesus was the inheritor of all the tragic literature of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a really strange idea. So I was like, huh, like at one point, and I love Balthasar because he's so all over the place. And so at one point he's saying all that, and he's like, well, we should probably talk about the Old Testament as a prefiguring of Jesus, because he spent 100 pages talking about Greek tragedy. Like, oh, you just showed your true colors there, buddy. So yeah, I thought that was really interesting, but he didn't like the novel as a genre because he kind of had a lot of those preconceptions that from Hegel that true literature is drama and the novel's too modern.
Yes.
So I used Thomas Hardy to kind of suggest that he missed some things.
God, Thomas Hardy.
I don't like old Hardy.
I'm just gonna stay quiet in this part of the section.
Thomas Hardy is not for the weak, is what I will say. Like that's some real English major.
Because of his style or the sadness or what?
Style is the sadness. It's
what was his most famous book that I would maybe know from AP English?
It would be Tessa d'Urberville's.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Read that one. Don't remember that being too happy.
You see Downton Abbey at the end, which is a great show, at the end of season two, and which is really moving bit, she's out in the snow because she's the fallen woman. And I was like, oh my God, it's just like Tessa d'Urberville's. And then they say something, like they make a nod directly to it. So 200 years later, that story still...
It still is.
Reverberates, yeah.
I have to tell you my favorite story about Thomas Hardy, though. And then when I met him one time. We had a chat when I was taking AP.
You look good for your age.
She said in the beginning, she does.
Yeah, you do. I don't look as old as I am, but when I was taking AP Lit my senior year of high school, we read Jude the Obscure, which is probably why I don't like Thomas Hardy. This probably was the wrong book.
Why? What's it about? I didn't read
Jude
that one.
The Obscure is... Jude is a troubled man, and there's a lot of like kind of explicit scenes in it and just really dark stuff. I don't even know if
I've been watching the Hillsong documentary, so you can lay it on me.
Like it's hard. I feel like it's hard for to even remember specifics. Like I remember there was sex on pigs at one point. And there was something about hanging a woman somewhere, and it was just a lot. I mean,
just some light reading.
But we were in class, and we were supposed to get into pairs, and we were supposed to come up with adjectives for Jude. And I just hated this book so much that I refused to talk about it. And I was paired up with my best friend, Ronnelly. And when the teacher was like, "What are you girls talking about?" I said, "Well, we think that Jude is obscure." And he was just like, "Christy, I cannot with you anymore."
Well, now being a teacher, you realize how annoying that Mr. would have been.
He told me I wasn't allowed to talk for the rest of the day. Mm. And honestly, it was for the best.
Those good old high school days where you can just be like, shut up.
He was just like, "I'm done. You can't talk anymore." And I was like, okay.
So Christy, I'm sure you've got a long reading list of various stuff, but if you ever had the chance and reread it now, I'd be curious what you think, because that is a tough read for high schoolers.
For high schoolers, I know. I have.
It's kind of dark, and it's.
And we watched the movie too. He showed us the movie,
right? With the woman from Titanic.
Yeah, it is. Ooh, and he was out the day that the movies got shown, and so we had a substitute. And I guess he didn't write down that I went to a little private Christian school. There was a scene that should not have been shown. But he did not write down, like, fast forward through this scene. Gosh. So we were all just like, oh my God. My college undergrad advisor, Jerry, who is, she's wonderful, and I've modeled most of my teaching off of her, has for years been trying to get me to reread it. And I stubbornly refused, but.
Yeah, well.
Someday, maybe.
I can see the reasons why, but it's so raw and powerful, and I think about it probably every 6 months. Like something happens, and it just reminds me of something in that book. Something raw or emotion or something. It's just
this is what she says too. So maybe between the two of you, maybe one day I will read it again.
I don't know if it's his best one, but I think it's the most awesome one. But I love the Mayor of Casterbridge too. That's a great one.
Oh yeah.
How did your students take it? What did you have them read it?
I used it once, but novels were hard with students today, and our students, they just I realized
they didn't read it.
They just not. Yeah, it's just a lot. So I felt like it was. I wanted to aim high, but at least something they could reach. But they were kind of shocked at the ending. It's so awful. It's almost comic. Like you can read it and actually laugh because it's a bit over the top. But they took it in the more of the awful vein, like, oh my God, I cannot believe what just happened. Cause like this whole family dies basically. So it's
spoiler alert, very tragic.
Yeah. Actually the kid kills the younger one and then hangs himself, I think.
Yeah. I think so.
They're basically, he's like, he thinks the parents can't support them.
Yeah.
So he writes, died because we are too many, but he misspells it. Like MANNY or something, and you're just like, oh,
that's so freaking sad.
It is.
So what was in your dissertation? What was your connection between? I know that you said that Jesus takes on the tragedies, but what were the main sort of novels that you used? I know you used Balthazar.
Yeah, I used four of Hardy's novels, trying to suggest that the novel is a tragic genre. Mm-hmm. Which kind of Hardy felt like it's not real tragedy because it's a novel. And it's a weird thing because I don't think anyone thinks it today. But in his time, in the earlier 20th century, they were...
Was it just the Greek plays and stuff?
They wanted to be classical. And they also felt like... I mean, the novel is a solitary experience. When you read it, you're not with others. You're not sharing that together. And that's a fair point. That if you go to see a play, it's live. It's almost like church, right? Like you're going through this thing that begins and ends and has this, you know, emotional impact that you feel with others. Versus a novel, you can stop it, you can start it, you can set it down, you can, you know, you can read it at the beach. You can stop reading it. But yeah, play is more like a movie in a theater. You can't stop it. So it has a certain power, as well as that the play is highlighting the fact that there's people on stage that are doing things and saying things. Whereas the novel gives you insight into someone's consciousness. Like you can get into their mind. And that kind of disturbed Hegel and Balthazar. Because they felt like it made us too alone.
Oh. Well, why did they?
Modern thing.
Why did they not like that we were alone? Did they think we needed to share like tragedy with others so that we would?
Yeah, I think they wanted to be a little more pre-modern. They felt like we'd lost something because everyone's, you know, choosing their favorite cereal and eating it by themselves in their rooms. Like, I mean, and that's a fair point. We're probably too solitary in the modern.
I mean, you
world.
Do have three sons. So you can tell.
Yes, right. I mean, I'm not against solitude, but you know, lots of people are lonely. So that's their point. Yeah. Like we're kind of trapped in our heads too much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, and too, I think that you can't quite analyze whether the novel is telling you true things or not, because you have to be aware of the narrator. Like, is the narrator reliable? Is the narrator giving you the full picture?
We're
not getting any kind of other feedback on that. You can get kind of sucked into like, this story is telling me the truth when maybe it's not.
I never thought of that, but you're right. A play does not have an unreliable narrator.
Yeah. Because of the play, you're seeing so many people and different perspectives and all that.
Right.
And the novel is like, unless they're doing it specifically, and then it's usually, you know, a whole trope, but most novels you're getting one perspective. You're getting, especially if it's a first person narration, you're only getting their understanding of what's going on too. And that may or may not be true, but we don't usually think that way when we're reading novels. I think when I tell my students like the idea or the concept of an unreliable narrator, they're always kind of shocked. Like, oh,
why would they lie to us?
I just assumed they were telling us what was going on. Well, like, they might not be, you know?
Or they might see it a certain way.
Yeah, they might be telling you what they think is true, but it isn't necessarily. And then if we're, like, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with the novel being entirely solitary, but, like, I think if you're not sharing the experience, you're not talking about it with other people, you can get very like sucked into that.
Just start a book group. Start a book club. Just start a book
group. Person book club.
That's right. No, I'm with you. I was arguing that there's a place for the novel.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
That he had, and that it could be tragic, and that the novel is actually the Bible is more like the novel in some ways. Yeah. Like it's kind of a hodgepodge of various things, and it's more interested in the common people, mm-hmm. which novels are very much tied to. They're not about kings and queens, but right. about you know normal yeah. folks.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of a gist of that.
And what was the connection Jesus. To Jesus with the books?
Well, because the Christ figure, the question comes down to what's an appropriate Christ figure? Does it have to be a Shakespearean play or a Greek play or Antigone, or could it be Jude the Obscure? Is there something about Jesus suffering and death that Jude speaks to in a way that Antigone doesn't, because yeah. she kind of dies a noble death in a sense. Like she dies for a cause and Jude dies just because
right.
he's kind of out of time. He's born in the wrong time or something.
Yeah. Oh, that's so freaking sad.
They're so sad, yeah.
I know that it's called tragedy, but damn.
There's so many scenes. Like he ends up, he wants to go to Oxford or Hardy's version of Oxford, Cambridge, and he can't get in. And so he ends up working on the walls of one of the colleges at the university.
Oh my gosh.
So like only Hardy would try to pull that off. Like he's a stonemason building the walls that keep him outside of the very school he wants to go to. It's like almost a bit, it's almost like Monty Python, right?
But like, you're just so like, I will say it's very well written. It's really, they're really beautiful books. Even as they're just so depressing, which again is very much my field, is like, give me the most depressing book you've ever read. Uh-huh.
You did tragedy and Christy did trauma. So together you make one hell of a dinner party.
Hide the sharp objects, right?
People are like, can you recommend the book to me? And I'm like, no. You don't want to read the book.
I was like proofreading her dissertation and I was like, look, I'll do the theology bit. I said, you're just going to have to do the literature because I don't know if you're right or not. Because I think my world was much more like politics and sort of systems structures, more like sociology stuff. And I mean, I'm not saying books aren't, guys. I was almost a literature major. I like literature.
They're just a little bit more subtle way of talking about those things.
I never had to write about Derrida, which I feel like is a real, which tells me a lot about myself.
Do you feel like, Kevin, do you feel like including literature with theology helped with your classes? Like, do you think that the students appreciated that combination? Or do you think they needed it?
I mean, the truth is I ended up teaching such introductory classes like ethics yeah. and church history that I rarely got to use it. But I mean, I think so, just because it
we had master's
so much friction. Too. Yeah, but I never got to teach it. I mean, I taught that type of material a few times
yeah.
with the undergrads with like a special topics or the mm-hmm. junior seminar.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even with the master students, it was very much intro to church history, ethics, yeah. systematic theology. So, yeah. I think literature helps theology immensely, because theology yeah. tends to overestimate its own abilities and mm-hmm. to think yeah. that God or human life can be systematized. And I mean, that's malarkey. Come on.
I mean, you're preaching to the converted for one of us. Yeah.
Well, and I will say, you guys had a podcast before.
We have a podcast, HAVE.
It's just resting.
It's just resting
because I hung out with you and he went and hung out with the gamer.
Yeah, and, that's right.
But we do have a podcast called Theology is Annoying, which is yeah, by far is
the best title ever.
And we have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We're going to drop a new episode just out of the blue and not mention the fact that it's been on hiatus for 2 years.
You listen to the last episode, I'm talking about COVID and I say, my hairdresser said she may not be able to go back to work in a couple weeks. This is like 2020. This is when everything shut down. I was like, she's going to be out of work for 2 weeks.
I was
like, Leah, don't be dramatic. Come on.
Yeah, it's actually
America.
It's a really good time capsule episode. Like how dumb we were about it.
Completely unaware. That's so funny. You guys should check it out. I've listened to it. They're great episodes. And I think that it's good how you guys talk about, because I agree. I think that theology, even though I do systematic theology, I think that when we only talk about it systematically, it's so boring. And like, right. And I get to say this because I am, but like.
We can also say it. We took the classes.
It's like, you know, look, I'm going to say it like it is. It's helpful in the same ways that I think the biblical studies is helpful, but like most people don't want to read those books.
No.
And I don't think it's helpful if people aren't reading it. You know, like we can't just keep all of the good stuff to the academics. And
I will say that I'd never heard of Balthazar until Kevin, and I did read some of his stuff. And it's actually interesting.
I like
the systematic world, because he is a wackadoodle.
He is.
Wackadoodle.
He is. I always was very fascinated by
and
him.
And I like it because like, he's not very systematic about systematic theology. No. He's just like, I don't think this anymore.
Right. Mind. And he's kind of conservative, but then all of a sudden he's like, okay, that was really weird, because he has this stuff about the Trinity being gendered or... the mm-hmm. idea of universal salvation, which he leaves open, like he zigzags a lot.
All over the place. And, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I was like, you can't pin this guy down.
Uh-uh. Well, because he's all just like God's a mystery, and if you set your premise as God is a mystery, really the world is your oyster.
I mean, truly, like you are set for life if your premise is.
You can be like, ooh, I don't think that anymore. God's a mystery.
And Balthazar, you know, he proclaims how the novel is an inferior genre, and then spends like 5 pages naming all the novels he really likes. And I read that. I'm like, this guy is just precious. I just love this dude. He's like, I love Moby Dick, and I love this, and I love that. And
oh my God. Can we also just take a second to point out, because I'm sure some people are like, oh my God, but to call the novel this like modern thing and to talk about it in these ways is giving me so much life, but like is hilarious because it's old. Most of us are like, how is the novel a new thing, and like kind of flabbergasted by this idea, but for academics it's not new, it's not old, it's new, but like we all grew up with novels, you know?
Right. Yeah. The time stamp.
What's the time stamp for a novel?
The first English novel,
I can hear you typing. I can hear you typing.
1600s.
No, I'm thinking of it's yeah. So 1700s, I want to say.
Let Clarissa or something?
Oh, God, Clarissa.
I think it is. I never read it.
No,
but,
me either.
But people argue what the first novel is. And as I recall, one is Cervantes' Don Quixote. But some people say that the Odyssey is really the first novel. But it's...
Isn't it sort of like a Greek tragedy, though, isn't it? I mean, is it...
Odyssey? Well, I think in the sense that, is it
poetry? Or like a play anyway, not...
Well, it's more of like a travel bit, but you kind of get into his mind and there's characters. Mm. Do you get into his mind? I may be wrong there, but there's arguments for why the Odyssey is novel-like.
Pamela is the first one, not Clarissa.
Pamela.
Was
that by the same dude?
Same author, yeah.
Okay.
And it's 1740.
Who is the author?
Okay, 1740.
Samuel Richardson. So yeah, there's a bunch of...
He just was really obsessed with like women with old names.
Women's names. Pamela is not a good novel. I'm just going to say that.
It's like the first hip hop album.
You know, like, yeah, like you got to give it some credit. But
what was the first hip hop album, Kevin?
I actually know
that. I have no idea. I remember when Walk This Way came out, the video, and everyone was like, what was that? Because it was Run DMC and Aerosmith. You're like, what just happened?
Kevin's of an older generation than us.
The first hip hop artist is a man named DJ Cool Herc. And he,
okay.
I'm not making this up. It's K O O L.
I don't believe you're making it up because it's way too weird.
But he, the reason that he is credited with this is because he started throwing parties in New York City. He started throwing block parties to like help keep kids like out of the streets and stuff like that. They were trying to like deal with the, because at the time New York City was like insanely poor. And so he threw these big parties and he was the first like hip hop like mix. He started mixing like we're used to with like the records and scratching and all that. And so he's got a whole exhibit and there's a museum. I can't remember what museum it is, but there's actually a YouTube video interviewing him about these parties.
And that's, it's a lot really of knowledge, cool. Christy.
It's because I teach Intro to Humanities now. And so when I introduce,
she always goes to the religion and hip hop.
I love religion and hip hop. When I do the music section, I do a whole thing on hip hop. And so I show them this interview with DJ Kool Herc. It's really fun to watch. But anyway,
I'm going to segue us. I should say, well, I mean, not that that wasn't interesting, but I do want to get to Kevin's newest stuff.
Yes.
Also, can you tell me what the title of your book is, that the latest book that you had with Routledge?
So I did Christ.
Oh no. You got to do bad theology. You just got to do it quick.
Because of the wine. We're drinking
Christ,
wine.
The Tragedy of God.
Okay. Whoa. And that's with Routledge, right?
That was with.
It is. It's not dead.
It's not dead. It's
still. Yes.
Okay. Christ, the Tragedy of God. Yep. Boom.
I love it.
Buy it. Do it. If you're interested in our chat. Also, Kevin,
I'll make you a deal on eBay. I've got some copies.
Oh, sweet.
We'll
put a link up.
Yeah. We'll put a link.
And also, Kevin did pick red wine, and I didn't even have to bribe him.
I know. Mm-hmm. We're big fans of Kevin today.
I mean, I'm in a penguin onesie and drinking red wine because that's the sort of day I've had. Yeah. Well, yeah. Which part is unbelievable?
The onesie.
Oh, the penguin. Yeah. You should try it. Onesies are kind of great, except for when you have to go to the bathroom if you're a girl, because it is a little bit bit like going to a Scottish bathroom because you just got to take the whole thing
off. Gotta get the whole thing off.
But other than that, it's just like a cozy little hug.
They are pretty awesome. I love my onesie. I need a new onesie though. Kevin, what is your new interest or what are you working on now?
Well, I am interested in games, like game theory type stuff.
Okay. Explain that to me.
Yeah. Well, it came out of the fact that I got into board games slightly before the pandemic hit, and then it hit and I realized, there's a real hobby world of board games.
Excellent timing.
Yeah, it was.
And he's got like superfluous children that he can ring into.
Yeah,
they're teenagers. It's a little harder now. You know, when they're younger, you're trying to get them out of your hair. And then when you're older, you're trying to find them. So they just kind of disappear all of a sudden. You're like, I think
I hope
he's not vaping in a bathroom somewhere. I don't know where he is. So anyway.
What kind of board games?
Any old stuff, but especially there's so many interesting things. We're living in a real renaissance of a golden age of board games. So they can really track it from the Germans it came out of the German world, but they've been into Euro games for a while. And the Settlers of Catan, if you ever played that,
came
out in 95. And that's just, that took over the world. No one had ever seen a game like that where you don't eliminate other players. You kind of do your own thing and you win by scoring, but you can mess with each other. So the two big schools of gaming, if you're talking board games versus, you know, there's also D&D role-playing games, there's casino games and stuff, but you got Ameritrash, which is usually luck-based and player elimination. So think Monopoly kind of game where I win by destroying you.
Right.
Which is fun. I mean, they have a place. And then Euro games
are less. I have
gotten into
some real fights over Monopoly.
I mean, it gets ugly and it can
Once
be really
Once you start
mean.
Hoteling up, I'm dead. I'm dead inside.
It can feel really mean. So yeah. Euro games are much nicer, and it came out of Germany, but they're being made in all sorts of places where you might be harvesting sheep or something.
Oh.
You know, like you're doing something very safe, and you're just playing on your little tableau.
Like the Oregon Trail.
Yeah, that is a game, isn't it? I've not played that one. Is that
Oregon Trail? Oh my gosh.
That was like the early
Is that a video game that they made into a
board game? It's an early video game, like computer game, really.
Right.
Back in
And you weren't competing against anyone. You're trying to get your people.
You're just trying to get to Oregon.
To Oregon.
That you you could die. You
died of dysentery. Of
dysentery a lot. Or you like try to forge the river and you die or whatever.
You lose all your cattle and then you die.
My favorite part is that when you died, you got to write the epitaph on your little tombstone. And so I would, and then once you died and your tombstone is there and you start the game over, sometimes you would happen across your old tombstones.
Oh, I've heard that's so awesome.
And I really enjoyed that part.
I played it in middle school. It was like this, when we had the like one weird computer in the corner, they'd be like, do you want to play Oregon Trail?
Yes.
And I would be like, okay. And then, it was basically trying to keep like your people alive. Yeah, and you were fighting against the elements. Like it wasn't
crisis management. Yeah.
So same kind of.
It's why we have anxiety now. It's because of Oregon Trail.
But not a board game. I don't think it's a board game.
So I was into this, and I kind of noticed that a lot of church people were. It's kind of like that connection with Tolkien and fantasy. Like there's some weird thing where Christians like making up stories, and I don't mean that exclusively, because obviously lots of people make up stories, but like why is it that something with the Catholic imagination makes you want to write about fauns and hobbits and dwarves and that kind of thing? Like how are they cross-pollinating each other? So I started doing a little just interest in games and how games work, game theory type stuff. So games are interesting because they create a magic circle. So you kind of like, we're going to enter this circle. And in this circle, this Monopoly money means something. These Monopoly pieces mean something. Yeah. And we're going to play this game and follow these rules until we're done. And then we leave the circle and we go back to our lives. And of course, church is the same way. You know, you're going to enter there. We're going to sit in this place and we're going to pick up this book and we're going to listen to this person talk and we're going to say these prayers, and then the mass has ended, right? And we all walk out. So there's sort of magic circles everywhere, so games are picking up on that. And then Moltmann wrote a book about theology of play, which is very interesting.
Oh.
So he kind of says that God created the world as an act of play because it wasn't an act of work. And we're ultimately made to play and not work.
Agree.
I like that.
So I'm not sure he's quite right, because work can be meaningful.
But,
you know, the idea is, in utopia, what would we do if you don't have to work? And another thinker, Bernard Suits, who was a philosopher and wrote a book called The Grasshopper about games, his point is you wouldn't even have literature because there's no pain in utopia. So there'd be no country songs, no Jude the Obscure. Yeah. So the only thing to do if you have every need met would be to play games. And that's kind of his argument about, it's one of Aesop's fables, the grasshopper and the ant. And so he's reversing it and saying humans are actually grasshoppers. We just have to be ants now because we're on this side of utopia. So Suits is not religious, but so you can make these connections, that you know, Christ's resurrection and the joy, right? That should make us live a reality that's outside of work.
Yeah. It's very up Milton's avenue too, because like hopefulness and stuff and play, I feel like that all works well together. But and then maybe you could even start to see your work as play if it's not like working for a living or something. You get to do meaningful work, but it's like enjoyable.
Well, we're all kind of teachers and ministers, so
I feel like technically podcasting is work, but like
I'm having a good time.
It's always just fun, so I don't really see it as that, you know.
I'm drinking wine and talking to my friends.
Yeah, but we're still doing that kind of meaningful work. It's just it's the redeemed kind of work because we're not getting paid for it. I like that. That's very cool.
So you're going to a conference. Did you go to the conference already? You told me.
Yeah, it was really a board game convention. 30,000 people in Philadelphia. Oh, God. It was crazy. The line to get in wrapped around the block 3 times.
Whoa. How was it?
It was wild. It was neat. It's a lot of publishers and demos and cosplay folks. But it was cool to see a whole nother genre of human living, I guess. It is like AAR, the American Academy of Religion. It's like that conference in that there are people in the back pitching board games, just like people are trying to get book contracts at AAR.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole culture of people that are there for work or serious. And then there's people that are kind of more of dabbling.
Right.
Do you think you would ever do a board game?
I have thought about Dante, because Dante's Inferno just lends to it. You've got levels, you've got bosses, like boss battles almost.
Mm-hmm.
So I've thought about it, and I've actually, there's a dude that will help people kind of with that. He's done some games in the past.
Ooh.
So I've done a little contacting, but I'm kind of lazy and it's a lot of work.
I mean, at least we're being honest.
Yeah. And even if it gets published, so if you get it picked up, it's like a book. You're going to make 3 to 5% off of the price that it sells for. It's a hobby. Yeah. Unless you own your own company, which some people do. But
just get in with that sweet Mattel
group. I know.
Up and coming Mattel.
Those 7-year-olds are going to love to play Dante.
The 7-year-olds love Dante.
Yeah.
That would be a really fun board game.
What game do you think is the most theological?
Ooh. That's a good question.
Thank you.
And I'm not prepared for an answer.
Okay. So I will say my husband, I'm gonna fill the noise and then you can think about it, but you don't have to answer. My husband used to play Dungeons and Dragons with Kevin and a couple other people. And it sounded very, at the very least, mythological, if not theological.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dungeons and Dragons is a lot of world building, from what I understand. I have never played it, so I don't know. But
a lot of good versus evil, it sounds like.
Yeah, one of my best friends, her husband has a podcast about it, trying to like help people understand it. We listened to a couple episodes and
you didn't understand.
I don't understand what's happening.
She's not going to do a podcast to understand the podcast.
I think we jumped in the middle and I was like, I really needed that intro episode. You're building worlds. You're deciding who's good and evil and like what's going on, from what I understand. Maybe I'm wrong.
Right. Yeah. A D&D type thing is a great example because it lets you explore different personas. Like you could be someone very different and live in that world. And it might help you see things about, you know, social anxiety, about yourself, about living in the world. So I could see D&D is kind of theological depending on the content, but also are you presented with ethical issues to make decisions about? There's a few designers that, well, I'll say this, some games are really just for fun and the theme doesn't matter, right?
Yeah. So, mm-hmm.
Some games actually have a moral bent, and Monopoly, interestingly, if you look it up, I think she was a Quaker woman, and it was a two-part game. Monopoly was supposed to teach you the evils of
capitalism,
yes, and private real, or she was against real, she was against ownership where you rented out property. I don't think she was against private property, but you shouldn't be able to rent stuff out for people to live in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think. And so that's what that game meant. And then there's a sequel to it, or a second game that was packaged with, that would teach you the values. I'd have to look it up, but there was a certain economic movement that she was part of. And they felt like you should never be able to own people's houses.
Yeah. I mean, the most angry I probably have gotten at board games is Monopoly. So I think she succeeded.
Yeah. I mean, now, the thing is, the other game was not fun, and so we only play half of it, but it had a moral bent to it. And there are these Victorian games in the 1800s, and they weren't great games, but they're supposed to teach you, like, to avoid going to pubs and to live a moral, upright Victorian life. So you, like, went around, and you're supposed to do different stuff. But people are taking that kind of game and rethinking it. So one person, Amabel Holland, she makes some really interesting games. She's got one on the Council of Nicaea.
Oh.
It's a little mean, but in it, you see, you're playing these bishops.
As was the Council of Nicaea.
You were playing these bishops, and you were trying to be part of the winning argument. But it doesn't matter which side it is. You just want to win. Has like an A and B side about some of those arguments about the nature of Jesus.
You almost said schismatic groups. Homeostasis.
Yeah. And so if you want to win the game, you just want to, you want to be with almost with the winning argument, and you don't care what it is. You just want to win. And
what
and
if so we play that cool on the podcast?
Just oh my God. It's our next YouTube.
It's a great little game. It's mean. It's mean. It has a lot of mean stuff in it. Like, I think it's probably a little unfair to Nicaea, but it's kind of right. But it's kind of right. It's like, it's right, but it's just a little mean about
it. You know, that was a bunch of dudes yelling at each other.
Yeah.
Just like, and then just like circle jerking. You know that that's what was happening.
And then poor Arius takes the fall for everything. He's like, I'm not even a white nationalist. I don't know what that means. And then B, like, he supposedly falls down and his guts gush out, which is how Judas dies. Yeah. And so, like, it's like he's cursed. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Well, you know, you get shared wrong, you get your guts out.
We get this game, we play it on Zoom, and we put it on our YouTube channel.
That would be fun. I don't know how well it would translate.
It probably would be kind of boring.
It probably would. But
well, you would need your own cards in your hand. You'd have to get your own copy, potentially. Or you'd have to play it at AAR or something, or meet up.
Yeah.
So that's a cool one. She's got another one about endurance, about the Shackleton. It's a solo game, and that's a really cool one, too, about how they survived. And she uses the whole thing as a paradigm, because Amabel Holland is a female transgendered, so about how she feels like her journey to finding herself is like Shackleton surviving his expedition. It's a miracle. So it's a really lovely, lovely lesson behind this game she designed. So she does some really neat stuff. So weirdly, the Victorians were right to have games that teach. They just need to be better lessons and better games.
Better. And also, I want to play a Victorian game that where you just like go to a pub and see someone in a gutter somewhere and like point and laugh. Is that the game? I mean, I don't know.
And then we're like, Leah, you lost. And Leah says, did I?
Kevin and Jenny, who's Kevin's wife. And I played a board game one night at his house. And it's funny because it shows my brain towards board games is that especially if I'm drinking wine, I just am like, okay, I can do this. But it was like about a pandemic.
It was pandemic.
Yeah.
You ever played Pandemic, Christy?
This was pre-pandemic, I should say.
Pre-pandemic.
It's a little on the nose.
I have heard of this. I haven't played. I'm not great at playing board games because I don't have enough competitive drive to keep me like
I've got going. Tons of competitive drive, but my attention span is low.
So my attention span is low, but then I also don't have the competitive part, so I end up tapping out. But like I've heard of, because I used to go to board games nights a lot, and I would just like not
so what would you do there, just hang out?
I would heckle.
Heckle. Well, it got to the point in the night where it was like the end, and I said, I'll just do this. And both Kevin and his wife were like, no, don't do that.
And you said, no, I'm going to do it. And then the world died.
And then everyone died.
Everyone died.
And I was kind of okay with it. I'm super, super competitive, but I've realized increasingly I'm competitive with myself. And so that doesn't really translate into board games, because I think I've gotten less... Since I don't play organized sports, I'm less competitive like with other people.
Right. I'm competitive in really specific situations.
You're competitive with your group in theology, I would say.
you're yeah, well, the yeah, predator. You have to be. Like, you can't do systematic theology and not be like, I will crush you all.
Which is, I do practical theology, so everyone was like,
But then I also,
they're like, you want to do like licorice and theology? That sounds really beautiful.
Literature and theology is the friendliest group of people in the world, and everybody is just constantly like, you're so amazing and lovely, and like, and it's lovely, and I really enjoy them, but at the same time, like, that's just, like, every time I go, I just feel like a little bit fish out of water, because I'm like, this is not how I understand how to do theology.
She's much more of a systematician than me, or probably you, Kevin. Well, Kevin, I don't know. Probably,
Well, naturally, I have that competitive edge, but I only own one board game, and it's a Yacht Rock board game.
I also didn't know what Yacht Rock was until I met Christy.
I don't know what that is.
I don't think it's reached the South, Christy.
Yacht Rock is like, it's like the 70s, like soft rock from the 70s.
You'll remember, Kevin. You were like 20.
It's like Africa, Africa's Toto is like one of the biggest Yacht Rock songs. Or like,
how do you spell Yacht Rock?
Yacht, it's like
yacht, like you're on a yacht, like a boat.
Y-A-C-H-T.
I'm translating for you, Christy. It's fine.
Thank you. Like,
it's like a boat.
That Colorado accent. I don't know what the hell she's saying.
I don't know either. Look, we got a lot of likes around here. You would have thought we had Yacht Rock.
But like, it's the best way I could explain it is like, if you were on a yacht with, have you ever seen the movie Overboard with Goldie Hawn?
Forever ago, probably when it came
out. I mean, no.
Like, if you were on her yacht before she like fell off, it with her husband in his like heyday of richness, and you're just like listening to soft rock, you're listening to Yacht Rock.
I feel like you lost us a yacht. Nobody has. We have pontoons. Nobody has a yacht.
I think this is why it doesn't translate to the South. You guys don't have enough yachts down here.
That's correct. Correct. I've never been on a yacht. I've been on a fishing boat and a pontoon many a time.
There's a great video that people put on YouTube about the development of Yacht Rock. It's really long, but it's really funny. But then there's this like been this surge of Yacht Rock in certain places. And there's a board game. You have to build your Yacht Rock band.
Oh my god!
So there's a website called Board Game Geek that everybody's into board games is on. Like, it's a database. So I'm looking. Yeah, I'm looking it up. Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. Yep.
You build yourself a yacht.
Say it.
Yacht.
3 to 6 players.
Yep.
Oh, that's more friends than I've got.
Well, Christy, you would like Pandemic because it is cooperative. So that's a kind of game where you kind of decide together, but when it's your turn, you make the final call.
You do.
But you're playing against the board. Yeah.
Yeah. If they look at you and they say, don't do that, you're going to kill the whole world. Do it. And then I was like, nah, I'm going to do it. It's fine.
Screw it.
And everyone died.
And then COVID came, so good job.
Yeah, I did that. Also, Risk, I think, is an interesting... We used to play Risk in Atlanta a lot. Yeah,
I remember people playing Risk.
That's popular.
Yeah, but I think that's a weird one, too, because it's like sort of like Monopoly, like life imitating.
It's just war. Like,
well, yeah, you just... It's colonialization. You're just taking over all these countries. And
you want to be a colonizer.
Yeah.
So that concern about colonialism is present in board game design now. People are aware of it and wanting to design games that examine power structures or getting the colonial themes out. Because some of the older games are really terrible. Like some called Puerto Rico, and you basically go in and just harvest.
Oh, no.
Just take everything and harvest. So they've redone it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it shows the sign of the times, right? And Risk, you're absolutely right. It's total... domination, and
you're just like, I got conquest. Australia. I'm just like, I'm like England. I got Australia.
That's right.
Oh man, yeah.
And then they produce for you, right? Don't they like make something? Mm-hmm. So yeah, production.
It's super weird. So, what do you think is the coolest new game coming out? Personally, I'm asking you questions that I didn't prep for. Or what's the one you're most looking forward to?
That's another good question.
I'll just dance over here. Yacht
it's
Rock.
Kinda, yeah. Well, it's partly because I bought some things recently. And so you kind of I think most people are like me, you kind of ebb and flow because you know it's a stupid use of money to buy bits of cardboard. And so then you back off for a bit and then you end up going right back in. So,
Kevin and I went to a game store in Charlotte where he did buy me a multi-sided die, I should say. But we went in and it was such a cool little shop. It looked literally like it was out of like, I don't want to say Harry Potter because it was too like 80s for that, but like there was a lot of like board games. And then you went upstairs and there was just these people in these rooms, like dark rooms playing games. But the guys, do you remember that, Kevin?
And, yeah, I do.
The guys looked at me like they'd never seen a girl. And I know it's not true because there were girls there. So it's not true. But it was such a surreal, I'd never been to a game store. And it was exactly as I had stereotyped in my brain.
Some stereotypes are true.
I mean, yeah.
Sometimes they come from somewhere.
I wanted it to be, but it felt, here's what I will say. Overwhelming feeling was community, I think.
Yeah. That's
for, nice. For people who, it felt like a place where people were like hanging out.
Yeah. Right. I will say, I very often lament my inability to like really get into board games because I do think that it's a great way to build community. And unlike novels, it has to be done in a community. You know, like,
well, you said there were solo games, Kevin.
There are, but to Christy's point, yeah, like there are solo games and it's and you're either trying to beat your best score or whatever, okay. but I think most people want to play games socially.
It's such a great way to, especially if you're like new to an area, is like find a D&D group or like, you know, kind of get involved in that. It's such a great way to do that. When I first moved to Scotland, I joined Meetup and the first event I went to was a Cards Against Humanity meetup.
Yes.
Right. We just like we're at a pub and played Cards Against Humanity. And I made a really good friend who I was actually just talking to today.
Oh, wow.
Kira. Yeah. Like it was a great way to meet people was to go. Cause it's something to do. And it's not like just going to a pub and like having to small talk with people or being
you
like,
you have a purpose.
You don't have to like worry about, you know, if you're good enough at something or whatever, you're just like, there and playing a game. And I think it's a great community building tool, especially good for
people who are going to new places or even introverts. Like I think,
yeah, cause it gives you like, well, and especially with, from what I understand, like D&D, because you're able to construct a character, like it takes some of that fear, like that social anxiety. You're not necessarily playing yourself, so you can do things that you maybe wouldn't do otherwise, and hopefully.
Did you cosplay, Kevin?
I didn't. I mean, I would have to buy stuff and or build it, and then I would have to check it, and that mean you lost me and all that. Like
that's too many steps.
Yeah,
you could go as a white theologian guy.
I could.
You present very well for that. That's
you did cool. that.
I did that from there. Just my sunscreen on. I was careful.
Where was this conference?
It's in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right downtown.
Nice. Yeah,
so AAR versus this conference, how would you rank?
Well, both of them, you can watch people. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of them are playing characters. I mean, I don't know. To be honest, I'm interested, like the AAR, I need the life of the mind. I want to hear some of the stuff at AAR and connect and hear what's going on. But a lot of those AAR folks need to play some games and loosen up and connect another way. So you really need the best of both worlds.
This is why Kevin and I are friends. Kevin, I need to tell you about the Scottish reception at AAR.
Oh no.
it got mad. I forgot the Alamo. I did miss you at AAR this time around, but
thanks.
Well, you would have left me though, I think. It was my first time away since Stuart had the stuff and like I went mental sauce.
Right. We also found a really cheap
That was the problem. And also that I wasn't driving because I was driving at beer camp. Yeah. And so I just was like, you know what? I don't care.
Loose and fancy free. And we were.
Kevin, I had a picture of me and my friend Joey. Like, totally nice picture.
Yeah.
And then the next picture, and I'm so sorry if this man is listening, it's just a picture of an AAR tag. And the guy's from Harvard. I have no recollection
and like,
of that conversation.
Leah's like holding the tag. So she's clearly meaning to take a picture of his tag. Uh-huh.
I hope that I told this man, like, I can't talk to you right now, but let me get back to you.
Who is this person?
And then that was it. The whole night, I had a picture of me and Joey, and it was nice and it was fine. And then a picture of this Harvard tag. And the next day, I'm like dead looking at Christy. And I was like, let me just look at my pictures from, because she was showing, we went to the Alamo that night.
We went to the Alamo that night.
We took some pics. And then I looked at this.
Falls off.
I looked at this picture and I was like, Christy, who is this man? And I don't know who this man is.
I don't remember you doing that.
And then I sort of low level screeched.
And the name's not in the picture, right?
It's on the picture,
but like, who
but I don't know what he was talking to me about. I mean, assumably I didn't just go up to him and say, "Ooh, Harvard, yay!"
Congratulations. Can I Photoshop your?
I mean, it is not outside the realm of possibility that night, but it's not maybe my typical go to. I think he came to talk to me about my book. Don't know. Right. So I'm going to humbly email him at some stage and be like, "Hey, guy, no idea. Good job, Harvard. Gonna need to get a recap." So anyway, next year is in
San Diego.
Oh my god.
Oh, I love San Diego.
Well, there we go. You're coming.
I love San Diego. It's my favorite.
Well, yeah, guys, I'm going to have to wrap this up because it's 66 minutes. We did it. And many thanks to Kevin for coming on. And
yeah, I will mention I have a podcast, of course,
called
Board Game Faith. So Board Game Faith.
Board Game Faith.
Check it out. Yeah, Daniel Hilty and I discuss board games and religion. He's a Methodist pastor out in Missouri.
Oh.
And, yeah. And we've had some pretty cool guests on.
Awesome.
Not us. But, you know, whatever.
I don't know that we won ourselves.
You destroyed the world with the pandemic.
We actually had a pandemic. I'm not saying.
And then Christy owns one game that no one's heard of.
So. Like, if you want to go talk about Yacht Rock and
how do you spell yacht? Is it like yeet with a different
yacht? Yeet. It's yacht rock. Yacht rock.
Y'all rock? Y'all rock.
So yeah, any shout out, so yes, check out that podcast.
Yeah, Board Game Faith.
We'll link that to you.
Yeah, we'll link to it and check it out if you're into that world. I know we got some listeners that love board games more than Christian.
Listeners, forgive us.
But we're still gonna demand to be on your podcast.
Poor Daniel and I are trying to talk about games and y'all are just
doing
whatever it is y'all
doing,
do.
Doing this. Kevin, this is what we do. Much like you and I will say.
This isn't a podcast, it's a phone call.
It is. We actually aren't recording right now.
It is.
What?
We're just shooting the shit. It's fine.
It is really just letting people listen to us chat about whatever is happening in our head.
Yeah. And then we drink. So thanks for the red wine. And I'm going to keep this train going, much to Stuart's chagrin.
And I will give Jude the Obscure another chance someday.
At some point. Yeah.
Not today, but.
I'm not going to promise that.
Not today.
I have it. It's sitting in. It's in my office. Actually,
your sad corner.
It's in my office, just sitting there waiting to be reread.
All right. Well, thanks, Kev.
Thank you.
See you soon.
See y'all later.
Bye, Christy. Probably
bye.
Won't see you soon. I'm sorry.
No.
Bye.